Good morning. I'm Zbigniew Brzezinski, co-chair, along with Volker Ruhe on my left, of the U.S.-EU Partnership Committee for Ukraine. We also have with us today two other committee members, Borisov Geremek on my right, and Jan Peterson on his right, the former foreign ministers of Poland and Norway, respectively. I would like to thank CSIS and the Konrad Adenauer Foundation for sponsoring today's event. The U.S.-EU Partnership Committee for Ukraine was created in 2006 with two goals. First, to provide strategic advice to Ukraine on how to further its reform process. Second, to offer recommendations to Ukraine, EU member states, and the U.S. government on how to further Ukraine's integration into the European and Euro-Atlantic communities. Last autumn, Volker and I asked the Partnership Committee's four task force directors to prepare a net assessment of Ukraine's achievements and shortcomings since it regained independence in 1991. By taking this broader look, we sought to capture a more complete picture of how far Ukraine has come and what challenges still remain before it. I'm delighted that we are today releasing the report, Ukraine, a Net Assessment of 16 Years of Independence. This very impressive document, and I really mean that, it is an impressive document, examines Ukraine's domestic transformation, pays special attention to the critical energy sector, and describes how Ukraine has developed relations with countries to its west and east since 1991. It covers the good news and the bad. It offers key recommendations for Ukraine, the European Union, and the United States. While Partnership Committee members may not agree with every recommendation, they concur with the assessment's analysis and the bulk of its conclusions. Looking at the period since 1991, Ukrainians can take genuine pride in important accomplishments. They have consolidated democratic institutions and practices. And it's important to recognize that. Ukraine has had the same problems that Russia has had, the same legacy from the Soviet Union. Yet Ukraine has successfully consolidated a democratic process, has had several elections in which a very simple reality operated. You did not know what will be the outcome of the elections until after they were held. That cannot be said of some other elections. The Ukrainians have reversed the economic decline of the 1990s and have put in place the basic elements of a market economy. They have established their country as a sovereign and internationally recognized state, and they have developed strong relations with the European Union, NATO, and the United States. These are important achievements, which might not have been predicted 16 years ago. In fact, quite the contrary. 16 years ago, some of the predictions were very dark indeed. But Ukraine still has a way to go in order to complete its transformation into a modern European state. For example, the country suffers from pervasive corruption. The state too often is tempted to interfere with markets, and Ukraine has failed to take steps to enhance its energy security situation. We state these things frankly as friends of Ukraine. Our purpose is not to compliment, but to analyze and to help. The report closes with the author's recommended key tasks. Let me cite a few. Ukraine should reform its constitution to draw clear delimitations of authority, delineations of authority, allow the market to set prices in the energy sector, work with Russia to meet their shared goal of making the energy trade transparent, complete the last details to its World Trade Organization accession, and conduct an information campaign to raise public knowledge about NATO. The European Union should broaden travel opportunities for Ukrainians, rapidly complete an enhanced EU-Ukraine agreement, and look for ways to signal the Ukraine ultimately has an EU membership perspective so as to encourage the Ukrainians to accelerate political and economic reform. The United States should re-energize a high-level dialogue with Ukraine, including at the presidential level, broaden travel opportunities for Ukrainians, and continue to work with Europe on ways to foster stronger links between Ukraine and the Euro-Atlantic community. Finally, I note the author's recommendation that the United States and those EU member states that are also members of NATO agree to the Ukrainian government's request for a NATO membership action plan. That is the recommendation of the task force. Some members of the partnership committee, for example, myself included, favor that step. Others, for example, my chairman, think that it should be, my co-chairman, think that it should be deferred, and different members of the partnership have their views, pro or con, as well. The recommendations are practical and with political will are achievable. Implementing them would move Ukraine further down the reform path that it embarked on in 1991 and draw it even closer to the Euro-Atlantic community. If Ukraine continues the progress it has been making, particularly over the past 3 years, if the government displays political will, and if Ukraine receives appropriate support from the West, there is no reason why Ukraine cannot complete the path that Poland and other Central European states have successfully navigated before it. Let me now turn to my co-chairman, Volker Ruhe, and the committee members, Bronislav Geremek and Jan Pearson, for some of their perspectives on Ukraine today. They'll make a few short comments, and we'll then be happy to take your questions on the net assessment or on broader issues regarding Ukraine and the West. Thank you very much, and Volker, the floor is yours.
Thank you. That's big. Well, let me first express my gratitude to the CSIS and to you personally, Big, for starting this project, because the idea did not come from the Europeans, although Ukraine is a European country. And this shows that this is an area where the Europeans and the Americans can work very well together. And as America is much better staffed with think tanks, we don't have this culture to that extent. It's an ideal situation, and I think talking about the Europeans, I feel at home in the CSIS with you as big as if it was a German one, or even better than if it was a German or a French one. So I think this is, and it mirrors the necessity to cooperate between Europeans and Americans on this issue of the Ukraine, because the future of the Ukraine is, and I've been there as defense minister as early as 1992, and a long time afterwards, so I've seen this period. Matters, of course, first of all, to the Ukrainians, but it matters to all of the Europeans, and if we manage to have the Ukraine on a European course, keep the doors open and have the progress, this is going to be important for the whole of Europe, including the development of Russia. And this is something we are agreed in the transatlantic community. Let me also stress this point, that sometimes when you just look at the topical news and see scenes in the Ukrainian parliament, people not allowed to speak, or somebody steals your voting card, which so far has not happened in the Bundestag, you start having some despair. So it's necessary to stand back and look what has really been achieved. And I think this is what this report really brings about. And let me put it this way. The main thing is that you are able to lose elections in a democracy. Everybody can win elections. I'm not talking about the message, but the test is also that you lose elections. I mean, without losing your civilian life, your property, your standard. And this exactly has happened in the Ukraine, that a government who did not like to lose, who likes to lose elections, lost the elections and accepted it. And this is, of course, a big difference when you look at the big eastern neighbor. The second point, and I've seen the Ukraine in before the Maidan, also is something I think which can never be changed by anybody. That's the diversity of the media that is there, and that again is a very important stronghold, of course, for a democratic development. I think it is important that the doors of the European Union and of NATO are open for the Ukraine. What regards the speed, I mean, we need the consensus of the population. It is there with regard to the EU very much. It is not there to the necessary extent with regard to NATO, and that has to be worked on. I think it is also very important that the European Union, which has been a success story, is really open to new members in the future and have the perspective of membership. This means the neighborhood policy is important also to enhance, but it can never be a substitute for membership. It can never be a substitute for a final membership. This perspective, this European perspective, should be kept open. All in all, I'm also optimistic about the situation, especially when I look at the young generation in the Ukraine. And I mean, the big impact civil society that has developed there. I think 4 million Ukrainians have been working and studying in Western Europe and in the United States. And when you look at the young generation there, and I should be more open, I mean, to allow them to come to study in Western Europe, in the United States. This gives us all great hope that we will grow much further together than that has been achieved already. So I'm looking forward to continue this kind of work and to the meetings which we will have in Kiev later this week. Thanks.
Thank you, Volker. Before asking Bernice Avgeremek and Jan Peterson to speak, let me take care of something that I was delinquent in doing, namely to recognize three other participants here at the table. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer at the extreme right, who coordinated this entire project and directed one of the key task forces. Janusz Bugajski, the extreme left, who was director of one of the key task forces, and and Keith Smith, who also directed, Ambassador Keith Smith, who directed one of the task forces. And they'll be able to also respond to some of the questions pertaining particularly to the report itself. And now, without further ado, Bernice Avgeremek.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I would like, first of all, to say how happy I was and I am to participate in this enterprise. Do believe that it's important that the Polish politician and a member of the European Parliament had a place in this work. I consider this report as an outstanding document, and his fundamental message for me in my reading is, first of all, the presentation of the Ukrainian achievements. I do remember when in August 1989, at the very beginning of the Polish independence, I received the first Ukrainian delegation in Warsaw. And we had, between Ukrainians and Poles, we had problems concerning the history, concerning the present. But we had the feeling that now Poland should support Ukraine on the path to democracy and market economy. And we try to do our best. I do believe that now, after this 16 years of independence, we can consider as Ukraine as an important political player on the European and on the global scene. I do consider that this presentation of the accomplishments of Ukraine matters. Secondly, I like it very much, this recommendations or task for Ukraine presented in such a document. It's a document presented by friends of Ukraine. Friends of Ukraine should be also critical on the weak points in the Ukrainian politics, first of all, in the legal framework of the public life and in the economic situation. I would like to emphasize also the role of the European Union in this process. The European Union not only contributed in the financial support to Ukraine, some 1 billion euros of support, but also in different heavy, difficult political conflicts in Ukraine. During the Orange Revolution, when Ukraine gave the proof that it is a Western country attached to the freedom and national independence and seeing its very place in the existing European structures, the European Parliament, together with other institutions of the EU, declared that the European Union is supporting Ukraine's aspirations to participate in all structures of the European solidarity and cooperation. That means that the perspective for Ukraine is positive in the European Union. I like this formula that the neighborhood policy should never be considered of the European Union, should never be considered as a substitute to the accession. It's up to the European Union, up to the Ukrainians to take the decision concerning the membership in the EU. Now, when we see this aspiration of the European people to participate in the structures of modern world economy and education, the EU should support Ukrainians first in facilitating the visa system. It's also a Polish voice in such a way. We cannot accept that Poland becoming a member of the Schengen Agreement will have to create an iron curtain on its border. It would be against the interests of the European Union, against the interests of Ukraine, certainly, but also against the interests of Poland. We propose now in the European Parliament a special visa system for Poland, for Ukraine, and we support very much Peter Mandelson's Commissioner for Trade activity concerning the preparation of a special economic free trade system in the relations between Ukraine and Europe. And we think also extremely important to see in what way the movement of young people, students, teachers, academics, toward Europe can be facilitated. The EU should create grants and possibilities because that's where we see the future of Ukraine. And finally, an important issue is the problem of the energy security. Ukraine was a victim already of some strong and aggressive policies directed against the Ukrainian interest. I think that the European Union, step by step, is building a policy of energy security, a common policy of energy security. And we would like to present this policy as a proposal to Russia as the main partner in this field, but also to all other countries who depend, as Slovakia or Poland or Ukraine, who depend on the energy security on the goodwill or badwill of the big partner in this field, Russia. We hope that this report will also help the decisions which should be taken in the European Union, and that Europe will understand Ukraine's situation and will support Ukrainian people's aspiration.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I think I just should contribute a few remarks. I find myself in agreement with much what has already been said. First of all, let me thank the CSIS for doing this report, and thank the two co-chairmen for their leadership. I think this report is an outstanding report, and I find myself in agreement with most of the recommendations. And I think it's vitally important just now, because it is important to have Ukraine higher on the agenda. I agree with what Dr. Brzezinski said, that I think the Ukraine can take pride in what they have achieved over the last decade and a half. I had the pleasure last autumn to see some of it when I headed one of the parliamentary delegations observing the Ukrainian elections. Obviously, things are going in the right direction. But as I read this report, the key to it is really the tasks which are defined for the future, and they are certainly, and that is certainly a very long list, which as I said, I find myself in agreement with. As we are getting closer to the Bucharest meeting summit, perhaps I should just add a few words on the NATO issue. I think the key here is what is said in the report, that the alliance should enhance its engagement with Ukraine. MAP may be one way of doing it, and personally I favor that, but the important thing is that we find ways of enhancing our engagement with the Ukraine. But as it's outlined, it is vitally important that Ukraine itself raise the public knowledge about NATO, because we need a broad public support. We need a committed electorate to if and when Ukraine is getting closer to NATO. So this is in no way prejudging a decision either by Ukraine or by NATO, and having people go with us is really the key to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Fulbright professor in Crimea at Tavrida University. And my question concerns the issue of the 2017 agreement with Sevastopol. As you all know, the mayor of Moscow is putting a lot of money into Crimea, both in Yalta and Sevastopol. And I have seen and experienced strong Russian influence, even to the extent of having one of my classes shut down by professors who would flunk all of my students if they attended my classes. And we also have evidence of the Russians spending a lot of money in Western Ukraine to turn the Ukrainian church towards the Moscow church. I'm just wondering what all this might portend as we get closer to 2017, and how you feel about Russia's capacity to still perform or provoke disturbances in Ukraine.
Well, let me make a couple of points in response to that, because I think it's not a surprise that Russia is going to try to have influence in Ukraine. I mean, just as a neighboring state. I mean, but I think there are a couple points to make in response to that, which we have addressed in the report. One is the sense of national identity that has developed in Ukraine. And this was interesting to me when I was posted there 10 years ago, but I think it's actually increased to the point now where throughout Ukraine, and even in eastern Ukraine, there is now a sense of we are Ukrainian, we will deal with issues as Ukrainian. The sense of national identity in the east is not as thick or as deep as it is in the west. But I think you see a country now that is increasingly unified and prepared to deal with issues as a country. So that puts Ukraine, I think, in a better position to respond to those sorts of influences from Russia. The second point on the Russian presence at Sevastopol, the Ukrainians have said repeatedly in public statements that the basing agreement for the Russian Black Sea Fleet for the facilities in Sevastopol and elsewhere in Crimea extends through 2017, but it's the position of the Ukrainian government at this point that it will not be extended beyond that. And what we've seen is the Russians, I think, would like to maintain a presence beyond 2017. There are also indications that the Russians are beginning to do preparations to expand port facilities in Novorossiysk and elsewhere in Russia proper. So it looks like the Russians, while wanting to remain in Crimea past 2017, are also beginning to make the practical preparations for the departure of the Black Sea Fleet from Ukraine to Russian facilities.
Just very briefly, and maybe to be a little bit more provocative, there is a possibility, and I agree with Steve, that East and Western Ukraine, a division isn't so simple. But Crimea is a little bit different. We do have a Russian majority, and as we know, some Russian politicians have been more active. One cannot discount the possibility in future that, that at times pressure will be applied on the Ukrainian government by using the Crimean issue. We've seen this at different times over NATO exercises. You mentioned a couple of cases as well. There are other reports also from the region. I don't think at this point Russia would want to use Crimea as a potential wedge. But as we know, the government in the Kremlin favors frozen conflicts along its borders because it enables them to keep certain governments off balance. And I wouldn't completely discount the possibility that the Crimean issue could be used in future. That's why I think it's very important for all the steps that we've indicated for Crimea, for Ukraine as a whole, to make progress on the economic front, on the security front, on the integration front, because that will better tie in the Crimean population into Ukraine and make it less susceptible to such potential Kremlin manipulations in the future.
Thank you. Yes, sir. I'm Dick Murphy with CSIS, and I have a question for Minister Gremyk. Following up on your point about the importance of bringing young Ukrainian students to Europe and the West, which is absolutely essential. But the question I have is, how do you encourage these young people to go back to their country to help out? I'm sure you've had that experience in Poland. I've seen it in Ukraine.
It's a good question. So we know it from the Polish experience. There's young people obtaining the possibility to study out of Poland, stayed out of Poland for a period of time, but they came back to Poland. And in my sense, they played a very important role in the process of transformation in my country. I do believe that as far as Ukraine is concerned, it's more, even more important because Poland was never so separated from the rest of the world, from the West, as Ukraine used to be. So this policy of grants, travels, trips, contacts, publications will be good for both sides, and I hope that it will be implemented.
My name is Vadim Gorbach. I'm an independent analyst. You pointed out in the report that political parties in Ukraine are top-down organizations and remain based. Let me make a quote from here so that the context is clearly understood. Political parties in Ukraine are top-down organizations that remain based primarily on personalities rather than representing platforms or large groups of people with shared political or economic interests. And parties are primarily catered to the interests of major business groups that fund them. Electoral votes in Ukraine are also based on the basis of closed party lists. In other words, the voters don't have opportunities to express preference among those in the lists. So, in the summaries, between elections, there are few mechanisms by which the electorate can influence the Rada, individual deputies, or the political elite. This seems to me as a major roadblock for democratic development of Ukraine. Concerning many other points like constitutional reform, administrative reform, territorial reform, at the moment the situation in Ukraine seems to be pretty stable in this regard. So all the political parties support the system as it is. So my question to you is under what scenarios do you think this system can change? Thank you.
Well, let me make a couple of observations about the current party list system in Ukraine. The first one would be that, in contrast to what you had, say, 10 years ago, where you had either elections by individual constituencies or where you had the mixed system, what this party list system has done in the 2007 election is produced a more coherent Rada. In this Rada, you have five parties, and that's an easier group to work with than, say, 10 years ago when you had 11 parties plus independents. The thing that I think Ukraine has lost, though, by going to the current system is the lists are determined by the party leadership, and there's no way for the citizens to input. So what the report here is addressing is, as Ukraine thinks about further evolving down the democratic path, are there some ways that build more accountability into individual members of Rada? One of the advantages of the constituency system was everybody knew, this is my person in the Rada. When I was living in my area of Kyiv, we had a communist member in the Rada who was the area's deputy. But everyone knew that was the person to go to, and you've lost something like that now. Now, that's not an argument necessarily to go back to the constituency system, but I think what the report says, as Ukraine thinks through, as it's going to further deepen democracy, are there ways to build more accountability into it? And one way would be to follow the Venice Commission's suggestion of making these party lists open.
Anders Åslund, yes, I'm not going to ask about the task force, since I've been involved a bit in it myself, but I want you to ask one of the co-chairmen, Dr. Brzezinski, how you look up on the U.S. politics with regard to Ukraine now after the election. We have now seen that all the major candidates have come out in favor of a map for Ukraine to NATO, but I'm not aware of any positions as yet on free trade agreements. Will it matter to Ukraine on these top issues? Who will become president of the U.S. next year. Thank you.
Well, as you well know, presidential electoral contests are not exactly the ideal setting for formulating complex and precise policies. And your question pertains to that. I think your question will be very timely after January 2009. But at this stage, I doubt very much that any one of the principal candidates is going to spend a great deal of time addressing that issue. However, let me say beyond that, what is important is that I think it is now a basic element of American policy to acknowledge and take very seriously the reality of Ukrainian statehood and of the importance of consolidating its political and economic well-being. That, I think, is a cardinal point of American policy. It is not directed at Russia at all, but it rather, on the contrary, stems from a very basic historical and strategic premise, namely, a Ukraine that increasingly becomes engaged in the global community, and more specifically in the Atlantic community, is a Ukraine which accelerates similar processes in Russia. And a Ukraine that does not do so, or is in some fashion excluded by the West, actually not only inhibits similar processes of change in Russia, but sets in motion countervailing and counterproductive tendencies in Russia. So that American policy towards Ukraine, in a sense, is based on two fundamental considerations: Ukraine's own importance, and secondly, its likely impact, a constructive impact, on the evolution of Russia, which of course is also of enormous importance to the West and to the United States specifically. There was a lady.
I'm Nadia Duke with the National Endowment for Democracy. I also share the view that this is an excellent report, very sort of high-minded and full of very useful recommendations. But as we know, it takes two to tango. Could you give us a little bit of a little bit of an indication as have there been some discussions already? We know that the Ukrainian parliament and the government is very preoccupied with its own issues right now. Who will be on the receiving end of the report? And do we have anything in the way of sticks and carrots for what is basically a sort of civil society effort on our part to enforce any of the recommendations on either side, actually? Because we still have... on the American side, quite a few more months before there is a new administration. I'd be interested whether there's been any reaction from this side, too.
Let me just start the response, but I'm going to ask Volker to comment and maybe other members here at the table who wish to do so. This report is going to be presented tomorrow in Ukraine, or actually on Thursday. And it's going to be presented in several ways. That is to say, it's going to be presented to the top political leaders of Ukraine, that is to say, the president, the prime minister, the leader of the opposition. And we treat each of these with respect because they reflect the democratic reality of Ukraine. Secondly, the report is going to be presented to Ukrainian public opinion. And to some extent, we're doing that through this press briefing today as well, because we know that the chances of the positive tendencies that we recognize continuing and the prospects of the desirable developments that we advocate emerging is very dependent on an enlightened public opinion that addresses these issues. At the risk of sounding immodest, we feel that we're doing something that actually hasn't yet been done in Ukraine, which is to step back and to take a comprehensive look at the experience of this nation state, which for so many centuries has been denied real independence and real peace, to see how it has performed during those 15 years and what are the accomplishments of which it ought to be proud and which are enduring, and what are the shortcomings that need to be addressed on a collective responsible basis. One sometimes does get the impression that the Ukrainian politics are terribly complex and interwoven and personal and short-range. And we hope that perhaps by making this contribution, we can help the Ukrainians look at themselves in a somewhat larger, broader perspective and draw more fundamental conclusions regarding their prospects. Volker. Okay.
Well, because talked about what we will try to achieve in the Ukraine, but at least as important is our work in Europe and in the United States. And from my point of view, the Maidan, the Orange Revolution, captured people's hearts and minds. But some of the things that happened afterwards did not exactly do this. People have become impatient, has become gray, more gray, again, the everyday political life. So what we have to create is, and I think the report is a good basis, a permanent basis to work on the issues here. I'm aware of it, that is a difficult job when you look at Europe, of course. I don't think there is anybody who would say the Ukraine will never be a member of the European Union. Those times are over. I mean, that was the case before the Maidan. But there are also not too many people, who would say there's a very clear and short-term perspective of getting into this. So I think with this mixture of what has been achieved so far by the civil society in the Ukraine, what's going on in the Ukraine, and the work done on both sides of the Atlantic, if we work together, I think we can achieve step-by-step approach, and this way make use of the charm. I mean, I think people have been very impressed in Europe, and I guess also in the United States, and they've seen a new Ukraine with the Maidan, which they had not seen before, and this is the big starting point which we can work on. But we have to do this continuously, and the things that have been mentioned here, they'll take time over the next years. And I think we are all decided to work on this together, Europeans and Americans.
Ambassador Smith?
I might just add something. Nadia asked the question of whether there'd been consultations or dialogue with Ukrainians. There are four task forces here. I had the energy task force. And I will say we have kind of comparable groups in Ukraine that we've been discussing these issues with over the past year, year and a half. I've had several meetings with the Ukrainians who are specialists in the energy side. So a lot of these recommendations reflect not just our views, but the views of a lot of people in Ukraine. And at the same time, many of us have also had dialogue with people at the European Union, both in the European Parliament and in the Commission. So I would, at least for my part, and I think from some of the others, it reflects a broader view than just CSIS, but a more European view and a Ukrainian view. Thank you.
All right. Yes.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Christina Kushnir. I'm a Fulbright student here in Washington. Thank you very much for the wonderful report and your answers. I have two questions. The first question is regarding energy independence of Ukraine. In 2003, European Union has finished the report on assessment of the methane hydrate deposits in the Black Sea belt. U.S. Navy has put together the map with all the locations of these gas. Canadian Japanese consortium has developed all the technology to extract these gas, and by 2015, Japan will extract the gas from its shores for production use. And I just wonder why Ukraine, having such a rich deposit of methane hydrate, is not paying enough attention to these gas. Your report mentioned deposits in coal mines, which is very important. So that's the first question. And the second question, considering the existence in Ukraine of actors such as Industrial Union of Donbas and other cartel groups, what is your assessment? Are they enhancing economic integration of Ukraine to Europe, or they are acting as a hinder to integration? Thank you.
Smith,
the second one,
One of the reasons we had a specific task force on energy is that energy plays such a big role, not only within the politics of Ukraine, but with the politics of Ukraine's relationships with its neighbors, not just Russia, but with Western Europe. So we felt it was very important to kind of look at that issue. It's also the area, that, in my view, in Ukraine that is the least reformed. A lot of the areas, Ukraine has made enormous strides in some of the industrial policies and economic policies, but on the energy side, it's one that's lagged behind and has become a real issue within Ukraine in the politics, and as we recently saw in the negotiations with Russia over gas deliveries, it's still a big problem. Ukraine is the least efficient user of energy in Europe, and this is a shame because Ukraine actually has an enormous potential. As we mentioned in the report, it's got oil and gas deposits both on and offshore that are very substantial. It has probably the best coal bed methane prospects in Europe. It has prospects for wind power, a whole bunch of energy prospects, a lot of coal. The reason it's not being exploited is really politics. It's really there's a fear of the foreign investor to some extent, or the fear of the Western investor. There's a fear that among a lot of groups in Ukraine that foreign investment is a win-lose policy proposition, that if foreign companies come in and develop oil and gas deposits and make money from it, that's a loss. So you've had various things like recently the last government passed a decree which, whether it was intended or not, drove out some foreign energy companies out of Ukraine, that Decree 31. So it's really that's why we put some emphasis on reforming the energy sector, because it's very important for Ukraine, and it's important for Ukraine's national security. The more Ukraine can produce energy for itself, the less it'll be dependent on its neighbors. And the more it'll be able to play a big role, I think, because of the transportation. It's right now the largest transit route for natural gas in Europe. And I think that, but this, the politics of it is what also makes it very important. I'll leave it at that. I could go on.
Second question.
I would say that the industrial groups, and you all talk about industrial groups in general in Ukraine, have had both a positive and a negative impact. The negative impact is that industrial groups, and this is not true just in Ukraine, you know, business in America wants to influence government to promote policies that are more conducive to its business. But I think in the case of Ukraine with industrial groups, they perhaps have too much influence. And in shaping conditions that are good for the industrial group, they are probably creating conditions which keep out competitors, keep out investment, keep out other businesses that could, in fact, be more beneficial to the broader Ukrainian economy. So I think as Ukraine develops, it probably wants to see a continuing separation of business interests from political interests. The positive thing I see is that most industrial groups, you know, my sense now is looking at what makes sense for their economic development. They're looking towards Europe. And I get the impression that a lot of Ukrainian large businessmen, they don't want to be Ukrainian businessmen, they want to be European businessmen. And increasingly there's an understanding that in order to do this, they have to accept European rules of corporate governance, European accounting standards, transparency. They have to be much more open, and they have to be a much more transparent entity. So I think in that sense, those sorts of pressures are going to be good on how the companies operate, but I think you're also going to see a number of those business people being a force within Ukraine, pushing for drawing Ukraine closer into the European and Euro-Atlantic communities. In large part, you know, not because they see that as in their business interests.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Georgi Tsikhiseli. I'm with RTVI. I have a question to follow up with Ambassador Smith. Ukrainians are not afraid of Russian investors. Why do you think is that? You said that they're afraid of investors in the energy sector, and you know, they're pretty fine working with Gazprom, you know, and sharing profits. The second question also for Ambassador Smith and also Mr. Brzezinski. Recently, there were some negotiations. You mentioned that Yulia Tymoshenko and President Yushchenko went to Moscow and they talked to President Putin. But they have slight difference in the positions. Prime Minister Tymoshenko is a little bit more strict. Let's put it this way. President Yushchenko is leaning towards compromise with Moscow. Whose position is better for Ukraine, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, you're right. I mean, it's the Western investor in the energy sector that's had the hardest time. The Eastern investor, I mean, you have the Russian ambassador to Ukraine is former prime minister and former head of Gazprom, and obviously he knows the area quite well and has been very effective in fact, encouraging the sale of three-quarters of Ukraine's oil refinery capacity to Russian companies. And Gazprom plays a very large role within Ukraine, and it's a very political role. But with Western investors, they've had a very, very difficult time getting into Ukraine. And I think that this is something that needs to be tackled, and the government says they're going to tackle it. Let's see, your second question was?
Negotiations.
Oh, the negotiations. Oh, my gosh. Do I really want to get into that one? All I can say is from my perspective, and I'm trying to follow this as close as I can, I'm as confused as probably any foreign observer. After the meetings, the meeting between the President Putin and President Yushchenko and Mrs. Tymoshenko's meetings in Moscow, I still don't know what's going to happen as far as the intermediary companies, new establishment of new companies. And this is part of the whole problem of a lack of transparency. I mean, if these meetings had been held more open or along with the energy advisors of the government, it might have been a little easier for foreigners to interpret what's happening. But right now, there's continuing to be a lot of suspicion of what's going to happen and what interests are going to benefit from this. So, you know, transparency, 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 I think, is really the key to a lot of the energy sector in Ukraine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Yotny Bakuria. I am representing my name is Yotny Bakuria. I am representing New Democratic Georgia in Washington, D.C. And if may I, my question I would like to address to Dr. Brzezinski and Mr. Wolfgang Huhe. There are so many ongoing conversations regarding how to replace Russian peacekeepers in breakaway region of Abkhazia and replace them with Ukrainian forces. And I would like to know what's your opinion about this issue.
Replacing the Russian peacekeepers in Abkhazia with Ukrainian peacekeepers.
I have no comment on that. I don't understand enough about the situation in Abkhazia.
All I would say is it would probably be better to have impartial peacekeepers in Abkhazia. Yeah.
George Kent, Department of State. I'm not asking a question as a Department of State official. Dr. Brzezinski referred to your difference of opinion on the report in terms of offering map. You had mentioned going step by step in working with Ukraine. One of the first steps would happen at the summit in Bucharest. And I'm interested in your thinking, if that is your approach in pulling Ukraine or helping Ukraine move, understanding they have to make the key developments themselves. What would be the arguments against offering Ukraine a mechanism that they could work on for the next decade, as the Adriatic Three have, through the Membership Action Plan? Thank you very much.
Yes, I accept it. First of all, I should say, I mean, that I have been a promoter of the opening of NATO for the East European countries, and I'm also promoting the perspective of membership of the Ukraine in NATO. But my experience has also told me that it is pretty easy to integrate armies. Would be quite easy. I mean, continue to modernize the Ukrainian army and make it a good NATO army. But NATO membership, you have to integrate people. And for that, you need the consensus. And that is not there right now in the Ukraine, as you can see. Let me give an example. When we had the first round of new members, Poland, Czech Republic, and then Hungary, they certainly did not join NATO to fight a war in Kosovo. They joined it for very different reasons, but that is what they found themselves in days after they had been received. And in this situation, it was totally unimportant to have a military contribution. What was important, and that was very, very difficult, for instance, in the Czech Republic, is to keep the support of the population, the Czech Republic, on this very controversial NATO mission in Kosovo. And this gives you an indication, I mean, that the real thing, and that goes far beyond integrating armies, is a far-going consensus of the population, which can also be counted on when there's a controversial step taken by NATO. And so my point of view would be this has to grow in the Ukraine. I think it will grow. It was also easier in the countries that so far have joined NATO because all of them have joined the European Union by now. And the changes in the civil society of these countries, from my point of view, have been more influenced by the perspective of membership in the European Union than by the membership in NATO. And this is how I would describe the situation. The doors are open, and it is up to the Ukrainian people to develop a consensus, and there will be a referendum anyhow before it is said. But it is, as I can see the situation, it is understood by many people in Ukraine right now as if the MAP decision, it is a membership action plan, is a decision on membership, and this is why it is controversial. But I would also say we need an enhanced program, and that has to be worked out in Bucharest, I mean, to increase the amount of cooperation. So that is the point. I think I was among the pioneers to open NATO for countries in Central and Eastern Europe, and that is also true for the Ukraine, but I'm very much aware that you should not concentrate on armies. It's very easy to modernize tanks, I mean, or artillery in the end, compared with bringing in public opinion, and this is what we need, an alliance such as NATO, and that is the reason why I say it has to mature, it has to develop.
Let me sort of spell out my position also, and I think the difference between us is essentially tactical, it's not strategic. We told the Ukrainians in 2006 that they should get ready for a MAP, membership action plan. They have now come to us at the highest level, the president, the prime minister, the speaker of the parliament, requesting it. I think if we say no, then we're in effect kind of putting the whole issue of eventual membership on hold and putting a major question mark to it, and also somewhat discrediting the government of Ukraine, which asked for it. Giving them MAP does not prejudge that they'll be members. It may take a long time to fulfill MAP, and in any case, at some point in the future, NATO still has to decide whether to extend membership, and most important of all, the Ukrainian people themselves have to decide whether they want to be members, and there's a public commitment in Ukraine to have a referendum on this subject. So I just feel that it would be a clearer signal and leave issues more open if we said, yes, we're prepared to give you MAP, though we realize that the alliance has to make a decision later on, Ukraine has to make a decision later on, and nothing is foreclosed by saying yes, whereas saying no has a somewhat negative implication. But I think that is essentially a tactical difference between us, and this is why each of us reaches a somewhat different conclusion. All right, next will be the last question, I believe. Who was it? Yes, over there.
Yaroslav Martinyuk, Intermedius Survey Institute. The panel has noted, and to follow up on what Dr. Ruhe has just mentioned, support for NATO in Ukraine is low. And Intermedia has been following the evolution of attitudes on NATO for the last 10 years. And what we've observed in the last 5 years is that the support is not only low, it's declining. It's half of what it was only 5 years ago. The good news is that it's higher among the elites, the well-educated leaders. My question is twofold. Can you talk about or speculate about the reasons why the support is so low and declining? And secondly, what does to what extent does the report address ways of reversing this trend?
Perhaps also some member of the task forces may want to respond.
I mean, it's not so easy also in sometimes in Western Europe to explain the new NATO after the end of the Cold War. And so it is can be understood why it is difficult to explain this in a country like Ukraine. But my feeling is also that you cannot just solve this with information campaigns and press offices, as has been trying. But I think the major politicians of a country on all levels really have to come out and explain what this new NATO is all about. And that is not being done. I mean, I have been in election campaigns in the Ukraine, and my impression was you cannot get many votes by talking about that. And this is why the politicians did not talk about that in this open way. And we also, I mean, we have our own difficulties. I mean, to explain the new NATO, new missions, Afghanistan. And then, of course, there are people, I mean, who in their brains still have the old NATO and think in these old terms. So there are understandable reasons why it is not so easy for a country like Ukraine and why it takes time. But there is no other way. I mean, the leadership, I mean, has to come out and not just take decisions on these issues, but explain it to the public and have a very open debate. And what I don't want to see is a referendum that fails. I think this is in the West that could happen, would send a wrong signal to the Ukraine. So we need some more time for this.
Just one word concerning NATO. Why Poles were happy to join NATO before the European Union? Because we needed dramatically the feeling of security. With our dramatic history, with our past, we needed this feeling of security. The answer came first from NATO. And we needed also to strengthen the feeling of belonging. To not be alone, to not be abandoned by the West as it was during the last war, and so on. This feeling of belonging found its implementation, its strengthening in our European Union success. And as far as Ukraine is concerned, I do remember 10 years ago, I came to Kiev as foreign minister. I spoke on our membership in NATO, and it was very well received. In the polls of public opinion at this time, some 60% of Ukrainians declared that they want to see their country in NATO. So why it changed now? I think that it is because of the internal political divisions in Ukrainian politics. So we have to understand it. We should never impose the accession. But we should not think that the accession to NATO is against the interests of the Ukrainian people. I do share Volker Rühe's approach that NATO cannot be done, and new NATO cannot be done without an involvement of the society. And so it's a question of work, of education, of information, and I hope that Ukrainian government will assure such an education.
Let me just make one final comment. which is really a reflection on this meeting. Just consider the following. Here's a group of, first of all, extremely important Europeans who have been defense ministers, foreign ministers, who have come to Washington to participate in a discussion of a net assessment of Ukraine. Doesn't that say something? And here's a group of several Americans who have spent a lot of time thinking and fashioning a comprehensive report on Ukraine. And last but not least, here's a group of people, quite a few people in this room, who have spent well over an hour in Washington, a capital oriented on many issues of the world, preoccupied with Ukraine. I think it says something that's very important and very timely, and on the whole, extremely promising. So thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much indeed.